614, Section 2, The Grassroots Civil Rights Movement. As you read, look for The Importance of Boycotts, Sit-ins, and Freedom Rides, The Role of Students in the Civil Rights Movement, Important Organizations in the Civil Rights Movement, Terms, Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Sit-in, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Civil Rights Act of 1964, Voting Rights Act. All of the activities by the courts were important to challenging the legality and constitutionality of segregation and disfranchisement. The court decisions and subsequent enforcement of those decisions, based on the rights guaranteed by the Constitution, opened the door to changing the system. But the movement for civil rights not only came from the efforts of the NAACP and the decisions of the national courts. Ordinary citizens, sometimes acting on their own, contributed. Their peaceful resistance and fight for dignity and justice was watched by Americans throughout the country. Gradually, the walls of Jim Crow began to crumble. Early efforts. During and after World War II, there were more acts of defiance against Jim Crow laws. In 1944, for example, students from Savannah State College staged a demonstration against Jim Crow bus laws by sitting in all the seats on a city bus and refusing to get up when whites got on. In many Georgia towns, new branches of the NAACP formed, and blacks demanded more job opportunities. In Atlanta, returning soldiers asked for jobs on the police force. In Columbus, Dr. Thomas Brewer began to organize African Americans to challenge the system. Under his guidance, African American barber Primus King and others tried to vote in a primary election. When King was not allowed to register, he went to court. The lawsuit, which included an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, was successful, and thousands of Georgians began to register. With African Americans voting, their neighborhoods began to receive more services and make more gains. Unfortunately, Dr. Brewer ultimately paid for his activism with his life. After threats from the KKK, he was killed in 1956. Buses and Nonviolent Resistance. Efforts to end segregation and discrimination were going on throughout the South. An incident in Montgomery, Alabama, was an important part of this work. In 1955, Rosa Parks, an active member of Montgomery's NAACP, refused to give up her seat on a full city bus when a white passenger got on. City police arrested her for violating the Jim Crow law. News of the arrest of this dignified, well-respected woman spread quickly. African Americans began a boycott of the city buses, refusing to ride until they could sit without discrimination. After a year of African Americans carpooling and walking, the courts found in favor of the African American community and ordered the buses desegregated. In 1957, Atlanta's black ministers planned a boycott to desegregate buses there. The challenge was carefully planned. Six ministers rode the buses, being careful not to sit next to any whites. Major Hartsfield was notified of what they were doing. When the minister sat at the front of the bus, white passengers got off. The bus went to the garage, where the six ministers were arrested for violating the Jim Crow law. This is exactly what they had planned. Their case went to court, which in January 1959 ruled in their favor. Atlanta's African Americans could ride the buses and sit wherever they wished. William B. Hartsfield, the Atlanta mayor during the 1940s and 1950s, was a racial moderate who received the support of the Atlanta Negro Voter League in his election campaigns. Hartsfield believed that race relations would change, but he wanted to do it gradually. He worked to build a coalition of blacks and whites to work for the city's economic growth. He thought that good relations between the races were necessary to attract businesses and investors from other parts of the country. He wanted Atlanta to be the city too busy to hate. Hartsfield worked with other leaders to have a peaceful desegregation of Atlanta schools in 1961 and tried to work with African American and white leaders during the bus desegregation movement and the student sit-ins. Although older black leaders wanted to work with Hartsfield and others like him, many student activists felt that his gradual approach was far too slow. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. The Montgomery bus boycott led to the emergence of some capable leaders and an organizing philosophy for the movement. The most dynamic leader was the young minister of the Dexter Street Baptist Church, Martin Luther King Jr. King was an Atlanta-born and raised African American. His father was minister of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in the heart of Atlanta's black downtown neighborhood. King was at work on his dissertation for a doctorate degree in theology from Boston University when he was thrust into the limelight by the Montgomery boycott movement. King and his fellow ministers, such as the Reverend Ralph David Abernathy, insisted on working for justice and equality by resisting the Jim Crow system in nonviolent ways. This fit well with their belief in the teachings of Christianity. It was the moral anchor for their cause. King said that the work for civil rights would continue until justice rolls down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream, a quotation from the Bible. King and other civil rights leaders founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, and moved its headquarters to Atlanta in 1957. The SCLC planned and coordinated the movement. They held citizenship schools where local African Americans were taught the nonviolent methods of the movement. One of Martin Luther King's aides and a teacher of these methods was the Reverend Andrew Young, a minister of the United Church of Christ. He had been involved in voter registration drives in Thomasville in the 1950s. He came to Atlanta to join the staff of the SCLC in 1961. One thing that King and many other young men of the civil rights movement had in common was that they were Morehouse men. As graduates of Morehouse College in Atlanta, they had learned the values of duty and service to community. The remarkable Dr. Benjamin Mays, president of Morehouse from 1940 to 1967, and one of the most respected African Americans in the country, was a role model for many. He became an advisor to presidents, especially John Kennedy and Jimmy Carter. Mays had been born in rural South Carolina to parents who had been slaves and then tenant farmers. Raised in poverty, Mays worked his way through high school with any type of work he could get, including cleaning outhouses. He then worked his way through Bates College in Maine, where he was an honors student and on the debate and football teams. He received a master's degree and a Ph.D. from the University of Chicago. He had already written one book before he finished college and wrote several more in his career. His degrees were in religion, and his religion guided his life. His second book was titled Seeking to Be a Christian in Race Relations. Mays believed in the dignity of all humans. He thought that segregation was against America's true principles. Having grown up in poverty himself, he was always concerned about the poor. He also believed in the value of learning and education. His own college education, he believed, had allowed him to free himself. At Morehouse, he tried to mold the young men in his care in these values. His own life was an example of service. He was involved in reform efforts throughout his life. He served as president of the NAACP and on the executive committee of the International YMCA. He was a member and later president of the Atlanta School Board, working for a peaceful desegregation of the schools. Mays was a mentor, counselor, and teacher, and supporter of the civil rights movement as long as it remained nonviolent and accepting of whites as well as blacks. Students and the Civil Rights Movement. In February 1964, four African American students from North Carolina A&T College went to the lunch counter of the Woolworth store in Greensboro, North Carolina. When they were refused service, they remained seated at the lunch counter in their coats and ties. More students came as the week went by, and the word spread to other cities. Within a couple of weeks, there were dozens of sit-ins throughout the South. A sit-in is a type of demonstration where people enter a public building and refuse to leave until they are served or their demands are met. In some places, the sit-ins brought integration of formerly segregated public places. In others, they resulted in white violence against the demonstrators. In March 1960, Lonnie King and Julian Bond proposed an Atlanta sit-in. On the advice of the president of Atlanta University, the students first published an appeal to the citizens of Atlanta to be a progressive city and end discrimination. About a week later, over 200 students staged sit-ins at lunch counters in the city. When talks resulted in no change, the sit-ins began again in October. One of the targets was the well-known Magnolia Room in Rich's department store in downtown Atlanta. Over 50 arrests the first day did not stop hundreds from turning out to sit in at lunch counters around the city. Mayor Hartsfield began talks between the African-American community and white business owners, but there was no progress and demonstrations began again after a 30-day truce for the talks expired. Jails bulged with arrested protesters and business sales spiraled downward. In early 1961, black and white leaders made a deal that desegregation would take place in the fall of that year. Only Martin Luther King Jr. was able to convince the angry students to accept the delay. Ella Baker was the executive secretary of the SCLC. In 1960, she worked with college students who had been involved in the sit-ins to found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which chose Atlanta as its headquarters. SNCC, an organization of white and black college students, was very important in the efforts to desegregate public spaces. One of the college students was Julian Bond. He had joined the movement while at Morehouse College, where he founded the Committee on Appeal for Human Rights. Bond directed SNCC's communications and edited the organization's newspaper, Student Voice. Another SNCC leader and chairperson from 1963 to 1966 was John Lewis, who later became a U.S. congressman representing Georgia. In 1961, the first Freedom Rides began. Even though the courts had already banned segregation in interstate travel, segregated seating was still the practice. On the first Freedom Ride, 13 blacks and whites planned to ride together from Washington, D.C. to New Orleans. The Freedom Riders made it through Georgia. In Alabama, however, white mobs tried to stop the ride. In Anniston, a white mob slashed tires and set fire to a bus. In Birmingham, the students were attacked and badly beaten. John Lewis was among those students. In spite of the violence against them, integrated groups kept riding the buses throughout the summer. The Albany Movement. In 1961, a movement began to desegregate Albany in Daugherty County, the first large-scale effort since Montgomery. In this rural area of the state, most blacks depended on whites for their livelihood, making protest a risky activity. Albany, however, had a core of middle-class blacks. Local citizens were joined by African Americans working with SNCC under the leadership of Charles Sherrod, a young African American minister. SNCC hoped to register African Americans to vote. That November, a group called the Albany Movement organized the fight to end discrimination. Protest marches led to the mass arrest of hundreds. To get publicity for the movement, Martin Luther King Jr. and some of his top assistants came to town in December and were arrested. When King and SCLC Vice President Ralph Abernathy returned to Albany in the summer of 1962 for sentencing, they chose jail time over paying a fine. However, they were released against their will when an anonymous person paid their fines. This active part of the Albany movement slowed down by the fall of 1962. The Albany police chief kept arresting marchers until hundreds were in jail. King left Albany, having learned several lessons that became important as the movement continued in Alabama. Although the Albany movement did not result in the immediate change that many had hoped for, it began a process of bringing African Americans more power. Enough African Americans had registered to vote to almost get an African American businessman elected to the city council in the spring of 1963. The segregation ordinances in the city ended, although ending the customs and practices of segregation would take longer. After Albany, SNCC workers went to another southwestern Georgia community, Americus. Outside Americus was the Koinonia Farm, led by Southern Baptist minister Clarence Jordan. Founded in 1942, the farm was a Christian community that treated all persons as equals, regardless of race or class. Throughout the 1950s, this integrated community had been attacked by white supremacists. When SNCC workers arrived, local activists were already there. The marches in the town began in 1963. During that summer, four SNCC workers involved in the marches and boycotts were arrested and charged with treason. They became known as the Americus Four. One of their defense attorneys was C.B. King of Albany. Their case, however, was eventually dismissed by the court. Civil Rights and the March on Washington. The movement continued in other parts of the South. With the lessons of Albany in their minds, leaders next focused on Birmingham, Alabama. As Americans watched their nightly news, they saw peaceful protesters in that city being set upon by police dogs. Police also used fire hoses, which were powerful enough to knock marchers to the ground or throw them into buildings. Over 3,000 people, including Martin Luther King Jr., were arrested. Birmingham police even arrested children along with adults. Dr. King wrote Letter from a Birmingham Jail, which appealed to the moral consciences of whites throughout the country. That summer, four little girls died when a bomb exploded in a Birmingham African American church. These events spurred President John Kennedy to support a civil rights bill in Congress, saying the time had come for the nation to fulfill its promise. The bill met immediate opposition, especially from Southern members, including Georgia's congressmen and senators. In response, civil rights leaders took their message and hundreds of supporters to the nation's capital that August. Almost a quarter of a million Americans, black and white, marched on Washington. The program began at the Washington Monument and moved to the Lincoln Memorial. Prayer, music, and speeches called for racial harmony, equality, and justice. Singers included the great African-American opera star Marian Anderson and the gospel singer Mahalia Jackson. Leaders from all five major civil rights organizations delivered addresses. Speakers also included white supporters of the movement, including a major labor leader, Protestant and Catholic clergy, and Jewish rabbis. The highlight of the day was the last speech, one delivered by Martin Luther King Jr., entitled I Have a Dream. King was a beautiful writer and a powerful speaker. That day he gave one of America's most memorable addresses. In his speech, he explained what African Americans faced in this country and said it was time to make real the promises of democracy. As he asked white Americans for justice and equality, he called on African Americans not to live with bitterness and hatred. Georgia was in his speech twice. As he explained his dream, he said, I have a dream that one day, on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down at that table of brotherhood. As he ended the address with a series of cries to let freedom ring, he once again included his home state, saying, Let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Stone Mountain was known as the place where the KKK had been refounded. King's inspirational nonviolent work led to his winning the 1964 Nobel Peace Prize. Before he could see the Civil Rights Bill through Congress, President Kennedy was assassinated. His successor, Lyndon Baines Johnson, a Southerner from Texas, made it his cause to pass the bill. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 made segregation and discrimination in public places illegal. That meant that restaurants, hotels, libraries, theaters, and the many other places open to the public suddenly became open to all the public. The act said discrimination in any projects that used federal money was also illegal, and it set up the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC. The act not only outlawed discrimination based on race, but on religion, national origin, and gender. Women were included, and before long, the courts were hearing cases of discrimination against females. Resistance to civil rights. In many areas of the South, violence continued. In 1963, civil rights worker Medgar Evers was assassinated in Mississippi. His killer, Byron Della Beckwith, was twice acquitted by all-white juries. Not until 1994 did a mixed-race jury find him guilty, when evidence of wrongdoing in the first trials led to a new one. He died in prison in 2001. During the Mississippi Freedom Summer 1964 voter registration drives, three young men, African-American James Cheney and whites Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, were killed. Georgia saw violence too. Lieutenant Colonel Lemuel Penn had done nothing to anger anyone. He was serving his country when he was killed for being black. In July 1964, members of the KKK in Athens murdered the Army veteran and reservist. Penn had left Fort Benning following reserve training and was on his way home to Washington, D.C. with two fellow reservists. On a bridge, a car pulled up beside his car and shot Penn. Governor Carl Sanders spoke for many Americans when he said he was ashamed for myself and the responsible citizens of Georgia that this occurrence took place in our state. Although an all-white jury in Georgia acquitted the two men arrested, a federal court convicted the two on federal charges of conspiracy based on the Civil Rights Act. The case and trial also led to an investigation of the KKK and its campaign of lawlessness and violence. Voting rights and changing politics. In 1965, the civil rights movement began voter registration work in Alabama. In Selma, over 2,000 were jailed for peaceful demonstrations for the vote. In March, protesters planned to march from Selma to Montgomery to demand voting rights. As the marchers tried to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge over the Alabama River, state troopers attacked and beat them. John Lewis was beaten unconscious. Following the first march in Selma, the protest continued. Two whites working with the movement there, Reverend James Reeb and Viola Liuzzo, were killed by the KKK. The day after Liuzzo's death, President Lyndon Johnson called her husband and assured him that his wife had not died in vain. Johnson said, "This is going to be a battle, all out as far as I am concerned." Johnson then asked Congress to pass a measure to ensure that every citizen could vote. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 made literacy tests and other methods used to undermine the 15th Amendment illegal. Any changes to state voting laws had to be approved by the U.S. Justice Department to ensure that they were not ways to discriminate in voting. To make sure Southern states followed the law, federal registrars oversaw voting registration and the voting process. The act had a major impact. Black voter registration increased immediately in Georgia and throughout the South. Blacks not only had more influence on white candidates, but they began to recruit minority candidates for office. Black office holding began to climb. In 1962, Leroy Johnson of Atlanta became the first African-American elected to the state legislature since 1907. In 1965, Julian Bond of SNCC was elected to the Georgia House along with seven other African-Americans. Two also became state senators. At local levels in cities and towns, school boards, city councils, and county commissions gained African-American members. The number of African-Americans in office at all levels continued to rise for the rest of the 20th century and was an established tradition by the 21st century. Andrew Young. One of the beneficiaries was Andrew Young, who had a long career in public office, both elected and appointed. Young was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1972. Georgia had not sent an African American to Congress since the Reconstruction period. When fellow Georgian Jimmy Carter became president in 1977, he appointed Young as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. There, Young became an advocate for helping the nations that were just beginning to develop and modernize. He also agreed with President Carter's concerns for human rights for people throughout the world. In 1979, Young resigned his position after it became known that he had talked with a member of the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO. In 1981, Young became mayor of Atlanta, serving two terms in that office. In 1990, he ran in the Democratic primary for the governor's office, but was defeated. However, his time as a leader in Atlanta was not over. In the mid-1990s, he co-chaired the Atlanta Committee for the 1996 Olympics. Both Morehouse College and Georgia State University have honored Andrew Young by naming important programs in their institutions for him. Maynard Jackson. Another important African-American politician was Maynard Jackson. Like Martin Luther King Jr., Jackson was a Morehouse graduate. He first won the vice mayor's position in Atlanta in 1969. In 1973, at the age of 35, he became mayor of Atlanta. This was a first in the South. No major southern city had elected an African-American mayor at that time. His two terms changed economic opportunities for African-Americans in the city and made it an attractive city for upwardly mobile minorities. Before Jackson became mayor, minority-owned businesses received less than 1% of the contracts for work on city projects. Under his administration, that rose to over 30%. Jackson also divided the city into neighborhood zones for planning purposes and included representatives of the neighborhoods themselves in the actual planning. Jackson convinced financial institutions in Atlanta to include African Americans and women. A major project during his term was a new terminal at Atlanta's Hartsfield Airport, increasing its capacity. Jackson could not run for a third straight term, so he was out of office from 1983 to 1990, while Andrew Young served as mayor. Jackson worked as a lawyer during that time. In 1990, he ran for a third term and won. From 1991 to 1994, he worked hard with business and other leaders on Atlanta's successful proposal to become the site of the 1996 Olympic Games. Accomplishments. The activities of the civil rights movement resulted in some changes in Georgia and other areas of the South. In 1961, the Lockheed Georgia plant in Cobb County, which manufactured planes for the military, became the first major corporation in the country to work out a desegregation plan with the national government. The company agreed to desegregate its assembly lines and to train and place African Americans in supervisory positions. This was a first step to more equality in jobs in Georgia. Cities and towns took down the white and colored signs that had told people where they could and could not go. In Atlanta, those signs came down in City Hall on his orders the day after Ivan Allen Jr. became mayor in 1962. Allen had defeated segregationist Lester Maddox in the election. Allen was important in moving Atlanta forward in civil rights. Under Allen, Atlanta's black policemen could carry out their duties with all citizens. They had the power to arrest whites as well as blacks. Allen ordered the hiring of African-American firefighters. One of the reasons that Atlanta had desegregated many of its hotel and restaurants prior to the Civil Rights Act was due to the efforts of Mayor Allen. Allen saw to it that Martin Luther King Jr. was honored for winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964 with a dinner that included black and white leaders, a major step forward for Atlanta. Much of the formal civil rights movement in Atlanta began to fade by the late 1960s. There were still racially motivated incidents, including a major confrontation in Georgia, the Augusta Riot of 1970. In spite of setbacks, however, African Americans had developed political influence, were serving in political offices, and were no longer barred from public spaces simply because of the color of their skin. Reviewing the section. 1. Define sit-in. 2. What was the purpose of freedom rides? 3. How did the Voting Rights Act impact the civil rights movement? Page 625. Of Special Interest, Music of the Movement. One of the tools of the civil rights movement was music. Songs bolstered the protesters' hopes and courage and brought a sense of solidarity. Many of the movement's songs came from the long tradition of African-American spirituals and church music. In December 1962, SNCC Field Secretary Cordell Reagan formed the Freedom Singers. He and Charles Neblett of Illinois teamed with Rutha Harris and Bernice Johnson. The group toured the country singing freedom songs to raise money for SNCC. In August 1963, the group sang at the March on Washington. In 1995, Rutha Harris brought back the songs of the movement when she founded the Albany Civil Rights Museum Freedom Singers, which still performs at the Albany Civil Rights Institute. Throughout the civil rights struggle, songs remained important. Words in familiar songs were often adapted to fit the movement. For example, in the song, "Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Round," the word "nobody" was replaced by segregation, then injustice, Jim Crow, and jailhouse. Songs often focused on the goal of the movement, freedom. "I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom," and "Oh Freedom" are two examples. Folk singer Joan Baez sang "Oh Freedom" as the first song performed at the 1963 March on Washington. Music such as "We Shall Not Be Moved" inspired protesters to stay the course in spite of threats, beatings, and arrests. In the early 1900s, James Weldon Johnson had written a poem entitled "Lift Every Voice and Sing," which his brother John Rosamond Johnson set to music. The uplifting song became known as the Negro National Anthem and was an important song in the movement. However, the anthem of the movement, and for protest movements before and after, was "We Shall Overcome." This song was sung on marches, in jails, and at almost all gatherings, often by large crowds with hands and arms locked together. These songs were powerful and unifying, helping the civil rights workers keep their eyes on the prize. Page 626, Chapter Review. Chapter Summary, Section 1, The Presidents, the Courts, and Civil Rights. The U.S. Supreme Court decision in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka declared the separate but equal concept unconstitutional. Fear by white extremists of losing white supremacy led to the refounding of the KKK in 1955. In 1956, white Southern members of the U.S. Senate and House wrote the Southern Manifesto attacking the Brown decision. As a show of defiance, the state legislature passed a law changing the flag of Georgia in February 1956. In 1959, a federal court ordered Atlanta to desegregate its public schools. The Sibley Commission recommended that the choice of closing the schools or integrating them be left up to the local school boards. Hamilton Holmes and Charlene Hunter were the first two African Americans admitted to the University of Georgia. Section 2, the Grassroots Civil Rights Movement. In 1955, after Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama, African Americans began a bus boycott, refusing to ride until they could sit anywhere. A year later, the courts ordered the buses desegregated. In 1957, Atlanta's black ministers planned a similar bus boycott. In January 1959, the court ruled in their favor, and African Americans could ride the buses sitting wherever they wished. Atlanta Mayor William B. Hartsfield worked with black leaders to peacefully desegregate Atlanta schools in 1961. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other civil rights leaders founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, in 1957. Dr. King was an important figure in the civil rights movement. Dr. Benjamin Mays, president of Morehouse College, was a supporter of the nonviolent civil rights movement and a mentor to many of the young men in the movement. In February 1960, four African American students staged the first sit-in in Greensboro, North Carolina. Lonnie King and Julian Bond led an Atlanta sit-in that resulted in desegregation in 1961. In 1960, Ella Baker, executive secretary of the SCLC, worked with college students to found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. Julian Bond and John Lewis were members. In 1961, the Albany Movement worked to end discrimination in Albany. While not as successful as some hoped, it did provide important lessons for the civil rights movement. In 1963, President Kennedy submitted a civil rights bill to Congress. That August, civil rights leaders and hundreds of supporters marched on Washington, where Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his "I Have a Dream" speech. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 made segregation and discrimination in public places illegal, and discrimination in any projects that used federal money illegal. It set up the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC. In 1965, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which outlawed literacy tests and other methods used to keep blacks from voting. Minority office holding began to climb. Julian Bond won a seat in the Georgia House along with seven other African Americans. Andrew Young was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1972. Maynard Jackson won the vice mayor's position in 1969 and in 1973 became mayor of Atlanta. Page 627 contains a review of Chapter 24.